the moon always aims the same face toward the earth. Therefore, the very far, the right-hand limb of the moon is always at the trailing edge, so to speak. You put a ionic engine on the right-hand limb of the moon. You aim it so that it is parallel to the earth's surface, the nearest earth surface it's parallel to. And so it's always pushing the moon in the normal direction the moon is moving, and it's adding energy to the moon. So you don't have to move the rocket ever. So no matter what kind of a rocket you would use, what do you mean when you said when it's on the other side? Give me a quick one on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm saying if you had a chemical rocket, it would fire, and then you would lose your circular orbit. It would become elliptical, so you'd have to match that on the other side and fire it again. That's what I meant. No, I'm not going to move the rocket on the moon anywhere.
Oh, you're way ahead of me. That's called a Holloman maneuver. Whenever you're going to put something in geosynchronous orbit, for instance, you blast it up to that altitude with a great big elliptical orbit, where the apogee is at synchronous altitude, and the perigee is something damn small. But whenever you make an impulse change in energy slash velocity of an object in central force motion, in other words, in orbit, whatever you do to change the velocity, you sense the maximum effect of that 180 degrees away in that orbit. So that's what exactly you're talking about. So to make a higher circular orbit, you would do a blast on the, when the moon is closest to the sun, and then when the moon is furthest away from the sun, you do another blast, and now you've recircularized that orbit. You're way ahead of me. You're absolutely right. But in the case of an ionic engine, it's going to be a very slow, continuous spiral because you've got continuous thrust. For somebody who wanted to ask a further question on this, give me a call with his name, sir. K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Yes, I think there was another person before Glenn, was there?
Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India, Whiskey.
That's Jim in the Toronto area. I'm going to go to you first, Jim. And I think you've got a question about this. First of all, is it practical? Don't worry about that, Jim. Down here, we've got lots of money. We can afford to do these things. BE3JIW, K2LAW. Go ahead, Jim.
I knew the line for taking all the unknown physics out of a simple question, but I'm trying to figure out, are we increasing the velocity of the moon from a 28-day orbit of radius diameter radius X to a 28-day orbit at radius X plus 1.5 inches for 28 days, or are we lifting the mass of the moon 1.5 inches? That was the question. I think we're increasing the velocity from radius X orbit in 28 days to X plus 1.5 inches in 28 days. I think that's the velocity change we have to achieve.
You're close to right. Remember I said you're adding energy. You're blasting the rocket in a prograde manner. And when you do that, the moon does go to a higher orbit. However, the so-called harmonic energy relationship, a radius cubed equals period squared. I think that was it's a subset of one of Kepler's laws. Anything that's in orbit around something else obeys that, I think it's called the harmonic law. Radius cubed equals period squared. So in other words, when you add energy to the moon, you do a prograde burn. You're burning it in the direction it normally travels. The moon right now is moving 2,259 miles an hour. Or if you like, it's moving 1.01 kilometers per second. But that's what it's doing. If you circularize the orbit and average it, that's what you come up with. When you make a prograde move, if you did it as a simple blast of a rocket once, you would instantaneously increase its velocity. However, on the other side, you would create a apogee, a higher altitude orbit. And when it's at the higher altitude orbit, at the slower speed, you now do another blast in a prograde manner, and now you end up with a circular orbit at the higher altitude. But the craziness of orbits, let me drop. The craziness of orbits is that every higher orbit is at a lower velocity and a longer period. When you move something to a higher orbit, it has to slow down in its miles per hour, so to speak. Of course, that seems opposite from common sense. Take my word for it. You go through the mathematics and study it, and it's a craziness. But that's the way it works. In fact, if you go one step further, the moon is a certain distance away from the center of the Earth. That gives it potential energy of altitude because of gravity. So it's got potential energy of altitude. It is also moving in a quasi-circular pattern, so it's got kinetic energy of motion. One of the things that's hard to believe at first, let me drop, is that anything in orbit, the potential energy of altitude, is considerably higher than the kinetic energy of motion. If you are flying something like the Voyager spacecraft, and you're going to zip by Mars, you're going to zip by Jupiter, you zip by Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, as you zip by each one of these things, you're aiming at a certain point in space. You're going to get a gravity assist if you do it just right. And at the instant you get into the vicinity of the gravity field of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, as you get in the vicinity of the gravity field of that planet, depending on the ratio of your kinetic energy of velocity versus potential energy of altitude at the instant you make the calculation, you can make a very interesting prediction. Let me drop. If in the path you're taking at this instant, you're aiming Voyager at a point in space on the right-hand side of Jupiter's orbit, Jupiter, you're aiming for the right-hand side of Jupiter, you're going to whip around the backside of Jupiter, and when you leave Jupiter, you're going to be moving faster. But you entered the gravity field of Jupiter, so to speak, when you got near it, and if your kinetic energy of motion is greater than the potential energy of altitude from the mass center of Jupiter, by definition, the path you're going to take will be a hyperbola. If the kinetic energy of motion and the potential energy of altitude is equal to each other, by definition, the path you're going to take will be a parabola. Let's go a little bit further. If the kinetic energy of motion is lower than the potential energy of altitude, by definition, the path you're going to take will be an ellipse. It will be a closed path for the first time. Now you get a little bit of a feeling for why, when you go near a planet and you want to get into orbit around it, you do something to create drag. You hit the top of the atmosphere to slow down, or you do a retro burn of the rocket. You have to make the kinetic energy of motion smaller than the potential energy of altitude in order to enter orbit around a planet. Elliptical at first, and if you're real smart, you can circularize it downrange. I wonder if you've ever heard those words before, Jim. VE3JIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Words, but not explained that way, and I know that QIQ was standing by, allowing me to ask my question, so interesting thoughts. I'll listen along.
Before we leave you, Jim, did you say you had a question? Because maybe I was so darn long with it, I didn't give you a chance to ask your question. Go right ahead, Jim.
Asked the question about whether it was just a matter of, it was more than lifting the mass, and I thought it would be speeding up the velocity, but you explained it was actually slowing down. That was my question, and answered.
Yes, this is one of those very many places where physics is stranger than reality. The physics is stranger than fiction. Opposite of common sense. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ. He's in orbit around Massapequa, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, for tonight anyway. But I actually have a question for you. Before you were asking Paul a question, and I wasn't sure that I understood it or I heard the question correctly yet, but I know you were talking about 2 newtons, and you were asking for some kind of a conversion, and I didn't get it, but I was listening. I know the question was actually directed to Paul, but maybe you could just restate it again, just so I could understand the question a little bit better. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, for the people who would like to live in the metric world, Newton is the very well-defined unit of force. And to put into the language of Newton, Sir Isaac Newton, the force that we call a Newton really is the rate of change of momentum of a freely moving body. Okay, and we rate that in newtons, and for us who live within the imperial world, we call it pounds. And 1 pound is something like 224 newtons, or 4.4 newtons is 1 pound force. So that's the conversion. But the original puzzle, I asked, I threw out, because the answer is damn interesting to me. The magnitude is very different than I expected. If the moon is moving outward in its orbit 1.5 inches per year, caused by the tide, if the tide stops doing it, and you're putting an ionic engine on the moon to take over and do that function, how many newtons, how many pounds, how many megapounds, whatever unit you like, how many pounds of force is required for that rocket engine? It's going to be an ionic engine blasting 24/7, 365 days a year. Continuous force of the engine is going to make the moon move outward in its orbit like it is doing right now because of the tides by 1.5 inches per year. How big an engine is required to do that? Because, let me drop for a second, I'll tell you why. Yeah, it was the Marchione Natal Rocket Company. Marchione Natal took on this contract to build this rocket engine to do this function. So your chief rocket scientist is saying, hey Glenn, how big an engine should we build? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I got you, Dick. I see where you're going, because initially when I was listening, I guess I was listening lightly in the background. It almost sounded like a conversion issue, but it really isn't. I see what you mean. KC2QIQ, thanks for the clarification.
Is the Marchione company going to take on that the challenge of this particular contract, Glenn?
I think that's a lot of force there, Dick. And there would be a lot of newtons.
A lot of fake newtons. One of the funniest force. I'm going to get a little bit obscene, so if you got delicate ears, you might want to hold them down at this time. There was a guy up my tower one time, and a second guy went up there to finish the installation of a cable and an antenna, and the an official of the company involved. There was an official standing on the ground asking me, hey Dick, is it all right to have two of my people on the tower at the same time? I said, well, let me think about that. I said, the tower is good for, Row 55 tower is good for 55,000 pounds of vertical force. That's about the weight of 10 Cadillac automobiles. So the tower can take vertical force at 55,000 pounds. The guy wires are set up in such a way it's good for 140 mile an hour wind. So I can take that much weight, and I can take that much wind force on the guy wires. So to find out whether or not it's dangerous for you to have two guys on the tower at the same time, your guys, how heavy are they, and how much wind do they make? Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Yeah, you always have to be careful with how much wind they make, Dick. K2RSW, KC2QIQ.
And some of the wind they make is from eating fake newtons. So they create newtons of force. There's a crazy way of explaining all this. If you had to make a wild-ass guess as to how many pounds, newtons, any unit you like, of force on that Marchione rocket engine, in order to move the moon, and it's going to work 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and it's just going to continuously blast this ionic engine. Make a guess. How much force would that engine have to do to move the moon outward if it's the only thing doing it? 1.5 inches a year, 3.8 centimeters per year. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
The problem with that one for me right now is I'm not exactly sure of the mass of the Earth and the mass of the moon, and I know their relative velocities, but I think just that the numbers are so large, I couldn't put an exact number on it, but I know it's big.
I just happen to have an answer for you. The moon is 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms. 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms is the moon. 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms is the mass of the Earth. So I'll repeat that. 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms is the moon. 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms is the Earth. The Earth is roughly 100 times heavier than the moon. I solved that problem for you. Now you're ready to give an answer, Glenn. The silence is deafening. I'll give you a hint. I was dead wrong. I made a wag, and I told Steve about it, K-H-U-Y-H-Y. And he made a wag. I think his wag is considerably better than mine. This is a tough one to put an order of magnitude on it. If you're going to meet a grizzly bear in the woods, you don't have to know his exact weight. He's somewhere between 400 and 800 pounds. That's all you got to know. You got to know you better be moving in some other direction or you're about to become a meal. There you can give an order of magnitude. But when it comes to the force to move the moon, that's a tough one. You don't want to even make a guess at it, Glenn?
Well, the problem is it's an inch. We have newtons. We've got a lot of things to look at here. And a lot of forces going on. We've got gravitational forces. We have the force to hold it in gravity, so it's got a forward velocity. And I got to think about this one. Give me a week.
Yeah, some of these things are already in beautiful balance, Glenn. If the tides were not creating the tidal bulge that leads a little bit because of tidal friction, if the tides weren't doing the thing, the moon would stay in its exact same, almost circular orbit forever, billions of years. So right now, moon's in orbit around the Earth, and it's a balance. And you and I know that an inch and a half per year out of 240,000 miles is an extremely minor perturbation. That's one way of looking at it. Not much energy required to do this. Another way of looking at it, though, is the moon is kind of heavy. 10 to the 22 kilograms. 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms. By my standards, that's a pretty heavy object. So we have an irresistible force and immovable. We got something that, to stay where it is without the tide, so to speak, nothing has to be done. We're trying to make this extremely minor change. One of the things you run into, you have to do some very funny mathematics to solve this problem. If you try to solve it directly, the perturbation you're making is in the 12th decimal place on your calculator, and it really can't handle it. So you don't calculate what happens per year. You calculate what happens per million years, and therefore you move over 6 decimal places, if you know what I mean. And it now brings it into the range. See, every calculator has an over and an under limit. There's a certain number below which your calculator can't handle. There's a certain number above which, if the number gets real big, a calculator can't handle it. Now, this particular problem is an undersized number. The delta you're making is so small, you run out of decimal places in an ordinary calculator if you're not using double precision, so to speak. I solved the problem by solving it for what happens in a million years instead of what...
Repeater, timeout.
I did the calculation for...
I think the moon is naturally moving away from the Earth by about a half an inch a year also.
Yeah, if you were here earlier, exactly 1.5 inches per year, 3.8 centimeters per year, N2MB, Barry, it's moving out 1.5 inches per year right now because of the tides. My puzzle is the tides stopped doing it. And the Forest Rocket Company is going to build this ionic engine, put it on the moon, and now the rocket is going to take over. How big a rocket is required to move the moon outward 1.5 inches per year? What's your gut feeling on that one, Barry? N2 Moonbound, K2LAW.
First have to know the exact mass of the moon. Then I have to know how much force to put on the rocket in the opposite direction. I don't know the exact mass of the moon.
Oh, you came to the right place. The moon has a mass of 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms. The moon is 7 times 22 kilograms. The next question you're going to ask is, how heavy is the Earth? 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. So Earth is 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. Moon is 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms. I've solved that problem for you. And now the Forest rocket company can give me a wag on this one. A wild ass guess. Roughly how big are rockets required, Barry? NQMB, KQRW.
I'll be back with that information in 10 minutes.
Now, looking it up is a little bit unfair. Although, by the way, the process of researching this problem is a very educational thing. If you like physics, if you like astronomical things, what am I trying to look at? Cosmology. If you like studying what Newton and Kepler did, to me it's a fascinating problem. Yes, it's a little bit crazy, because, let's face it, in Far Rockaway, they're not going to build this rocket. And even if they did, they wouldn't earn any money doing it, so it's not practical. But real scientific-type ham radio operators, they don't have to be practical. All they've got to do is something that's fun. Back to you for any comments on this, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
Celestial mechanics.
I actually am sitting here trying to figure out what way, what you could do to do that. I'm thinking maybe perhaps a giant bomb or something. You know, trying to come up with a method that would be actually feasible.
Oh, the concept of how to do it has already been worked out for you. And there's a requirement to bid on this contract. It is going to be a continuously operating bionic engine. So, 24/7, 365 days a year, this ionic engine mounted on the right-hand limb of the moon.
Now, you said you wanted to do it in 1 year. That engine would have to be awfully powerful to accomplish that in 1 year. That was the stipulation. I'm thinking of doing it in less than a year, but doing it, and the only way I could think of doing that would be an atomic explosion at the right part of the moon at the right moment.
No, you've misunderstood the problem. The moon is continuously moving outward 1.5 inches per year, year in and year out, 1.5 inches per year. The tides are doing it right now. For some reason, in my crazy scenario, the tides stopped doing it. Maybe all the water dried up on the Earth, or it froze over, or whatever. So, but because of global warming, it all boiled away. The tides are no longer there. Assuming the tides are doing all of it, and the tides are no longer doing it. And now you're going to do it with a continuously operating ionic engine, and it's going to continue to move the moon out 1.5 inches per year, every year from now on. This engine is going to continuously be running 24/7, 365 days a year. How big an engine is required to do that, Barry? Over to you, K2LAW.
That will take a little thinking, but that's going to be a big engine. It's going to be a Titanic engine. But give me a little time and I'll come up with some numbers for you. I mean it.
The answer will amaze you. I didn't say how big or how small. I just said the answer will amaze you. At least it amazed me. Okay. Anybody with any further questions or comments on all of this craziness tonight?
What's coming to my mind is this is not going to be a very big engine. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether or not you would want to take on this project. But maybe you would. Think big. How are you, Barry?
I'm thinking that the engine isn't going to be as big as everybody thinks it is. That's what's coming to my head. Let me do a little research and I'll get back to you. Something tells me this isn't as big as it should be.
There's a little bit of craziness to this problem. You're going to try loading it into your handheld calculator, and you're going to say, whoa, I've run out of decimal places. I can't do this. So, by the way, that's a classic problem. Every calculator has an underflow and overflow limit. There's a number below which your calculator cannot represent because the number's too small. Or there's a number too big where your calculator can't represent it. I had to change the batteries in my calculator during this process for a very good reason, which I can tell you in private, Barry. Okay. See how we're doing in time here. I think we've exhausted this one. This, by the way, has two or three other corollary puzzles. But this one is enough challenge as it is. There's a degree of realisticness here. And there's a degree of craziness, of course. But part of that makes it fun. I know you've got at least one more mailbag question, John. And make sure you choose the right microphone. You scared us there before. I thought somebody else came into the room and took over. KC2WTV, K2REW.
got the right one this time. Well, it's nuts. Yes, I do. Let me get my little list here. All right. I'll let it drop and go on to the question. Dick, if you remember, we were discussing the envelope of radiation on a dipole antenna. The question was the fact that this gentleman knows there are high voltage points and low current points, but is trying to find out what the general area of the antenna. You covered some of this before answering Doug's question, but he wants to know how the power stays constant for the length of the antenna line. So maybe you could explain that relationship between the voltage area and the current areas of the antenna, how when it's ascending and what is descending, and how it all works out in the long path. Also, you may want to go into your bubble theory a little bit just to cover that. So maybe that'll clear up some things for him. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
We now know, by way of what we've been saying now for a couple of years on the TechNet, we meaning me, me and the mouse in my pocket, the royal we, have been saying for a couple of years, this is a magic piece of information that's not in any good antenna engineering handbook that I know of, that the RF energy bounces back and forth roughly 20 times on your dipole-like antenna and many other antennas, but the dipole-like antenna energy bounces back and forth 20 times before it finally gets radiated in space. On the first pass down the wire, 5% of the energy gets radiated, 95% goes down to the far end of your dipole. It's the open circuit where you've got the egg insulator and reflects back. Because the energy is traveling all the way down to the end and all the way back, is there more energy in the center than the end, or more energy in the end than the center? Absolutely not. It's an extremely clear, extremely uniform amount of energy on every place of that wire. Total energy that you're transmitting. The whole darn wire is doing it. Let me drop. However, when you've been smart enough to resonate that wire, you make it electronically the right length, which in the case of a simple dipole, it's physically the right length, 0.95 times half wavelength. And that 0.95 instead of 1.0 is because the egg insulator in the end gives you some end capacitance. So that is a simple wire dipole antenna, 80 meters, it's 132 feet long, 40 meters, it's somewhere around 67 feet long, and so on. The energy you happen to have because of the standing wave of the signal bouncing back and forth, there is more current in the center. There is more voltage at the end. All right. You then ask the question, is the energy in the current or is the energy in the voltage? And the answer is yes. They both got to be there. And so you could say that the energy is slow because of the standing wave. It acts as if the energy slowly converts itself from current energy near the center to voltage energy at the end. But that's simplistic. It's really real TEM energy bouncing back and forth on a wire. Let me drop. Now, when it comes to the pattern you get out of a dipole, everybody shows it as a donut in free space, a three-dimensional donut, with the wire going down the center of the hole of the donut. That is a model. That is a representation. It is a way of conveying a concept. The geometric center of the hole of that donut, call it ground zero. And now I move my piece of wire through the donut, and depending on what angle I choose from geometric center, I either go through a portion of the donut that stick or a portion of the donut that ain't there. The thickness of the donut that the wire goes through tells you how much energy is going in that direction. That's what that model is intended to do. In the case of a Yagi antenna, the antenna pattern looks like a cucumber. And so I could take a piece of wire from the center of the cucumber right at the driven element at one end, and as I draw that wire at various angles through the cucumber, where the wire hits the outer surface of the cucumber is a certain distance of wire, and the distance from the center near the driven element out to where the wire pierces the skin of the cucumber, that distance represents the amount of energy in that direction. This is a model telling you something about antenna pattern. Be careful. 99% of the world falls into a trap with that damn model. Let me drop. Now let's go to the imaginary world where everything is perfect and your eyes operate at radio frequencies. And, yes, the signal comes out of there at the speed of light and your eye doesn't work that fast. By some magic, you slow down the signal so that you can see this animation as the signal is coming out of your Yagi antenna or out of your dipole. And the next question, everybody believes that your eyes being able to see that radio wave are going to see that donut and going to see that cucumber. Absolutely not. That diagram has led you down the garden path. That is a representation of signal versus angle, three-dimensional angle. It's a representation. It's a way of graphing and displaying. It has nothing to do with reality. You do a real careful study. You fly your helicopter around this 80-meter dipole, for instance. Assume the 80-meter dipole is so high in the air that you can forget about ground reflection. Let's make it simple. There ain't no ground reflection. You have a real horizontal dipole parallel to the Earth, high enough in the air, it's radiating a kilowatt of energy, and you're flying your helicopter around this 80-meter dipole, and you got this perfect signal strength, you have this perfect, what's the word I'm looking for now? Wave meter, signal strength meter? What do we call that thing? Another thing that measures the signal strength, radiated signal strength.
Signal strength meter would be good enough.
That's the word I'm looking for. My mind's going blank here. I say I have this beautiful, perfect field strength meter, traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. So the field strength meter is, I got one of them at the front of the helicopter, the back of the helicopter, the side of the helicopter, no matter what the orientation of the helicopter is. I fly in three-dimensional space, high, low, left, right, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, azimuth around the around the dipole. I fly all around the dipole, and I gather all this data. And if I choose to represent the signal strength, measured with my field strength meter, and all those points in space, and if I choose to represent it as the length of a piece of wire, so to speak, from some geometric point in the middle of the dipole, yes, I can make my representation look like a dipole, for a donut for the dipole, and look like a cucumber for the Yagi antenna. But that's not what happens. You now go the next step, and you slow down the movie, and your eye is operating at RF frequency, and you're looking at the phase front of the first cycle of RF energy coming out of that dipole. What would you see? And there's an article that you can go to the Mike and Mike websites. One Mike is a K1NJI. That's the one that's amateurradio.tv. That's where you can look at recordings and some of these articles. I think this article is there, too. And also Mike number two, K1MJM, his website, which is technetlimarch.org, or technetlimarch.com, I think it is. Anyhow, you go to that website, the K1MJM website, mic number two, and you will see an article called the Bubble Article, which is also called the Scattering Area Article, and you start reading it. And what will you read? I am very sure, not absolutely positive, I wouldn't bet my life on it, but I would bet 90% of my money, that if my eyes operated at RF frequency, I could slow it down, the energy coming away from that dipole would look like a bubble. The bubble would be expanding at the speed of light. Yes, the bubble is brighter in certain directions. Broadside to the dipole, the bubble is thick and bright. At the ends of the dipole, in that direction, the bubble is very thin and dim and almost looks like it's got a hole in it, but is a completely spherical bubble expanding away from that antenna. The real radio wave is a spherical wavefront. Let me drop. And yes, it is stronger in some directions and weaker in some directions. That's why I call it brighter bubble or dimmer bubble. And if a bright and dim bubble bothers you, because somebody was having a little trouble gathering that one, swallowing that one, I made a slight modification of that. Assume my dipole completely vertical dipole, perpendicular to the earth, and I've blown up a child's rubber balloon. and the dipole, and the weather balloon started off clear. And now I'm going to use bright paint to paint the equator of that bubble. Assume it's a sphere. And the wire is coming from the South Pole to the North Pole is where the wire of the dipole is going through. And at the equator of this child's party balloon, I'm going to paint it nice and bright near the equator. A little bit further away from the equator, I'm going to use slightly dimmer paint. And as I go further and further away from the equator, the paint that I put on the clear balloon is less and less bright. And by the time I get to the North Pole or the South Pole of this rubber balloon, I'm putting no paint there at all. So the brightness of the paint in various areas on this balloon represents the strength of the signal coming off that dipole. So whether I do it as a balloon that's being blown up or as a soap bubble that's being expanded and the bubble is thick in some areas and bright and dim, doesn't matter. That is the real signal, the real phase front, the real antenna pattern. There ain't no dipole, there ain't no donut in space. That's just a representation of the people I consult for. Let me drop. Of the people that I consult for, an amazing number of them want to buy an antenna that has that particular donut pattern, some of the pattern. And they want to be able to confirm that pattern by various measurements. Yes, an antenna range will make measurements for you, signal strength versus angst, where you can display it that way. But that's not the way the signal really comes to go. So there's a lot of misconception here as to the way the information is being displayed to people. I haven't read the bubble philosophy of antenna radiation anywhere. Of the 50 books on antennas that I own, I've never read that puzzle, I've never read that method of explanation before. Maybe it's unique, but I think it's closer to the truth. Therefore, I think it's valuable. That donut pattern doesn't really exist. It's just a way of displaying data. You guys probably got some questions on this one. I'm going to pass it over to John, and I'll give some delay in case anybody wants to ask a question. KC2WGB with a delay. K2LIW in the TechNet. KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yep, I'm going to let it drop again just in case somebody, because they may not be able to get in because of the nuisance. Let's see what happens. KC2WGB. Yeah, right now, we do need a greater number of FAP scans. And so what the... let's see now, who was that earlier? KC2MDP, Steve, what he's working on. We need more of them. And maybe this should be a... what's the word for it? A group effort at LIMARC to build more FAP scans. Because if they have the hardware, they will come. If we have the hardware, they'll get used. And so we could use some more DAP scans. Over to you, John. KC2WGB. K2R. There's never enough of those. K2R, they'll be listening.
Well, if I go ahead with the tower, I will definitely install a DAP scanner here, which will function. And it should do a very good job from here, because sometimes these signals are really strong.
Yeah, I understand. When I listen to the input, I'm amazed at what I hear from time to time. John, go ahead.
But Nick, you may also want to explain what happens to that balloon as a function of power being supplied to the antenna, the RF power in itself, how it expands, and how it maintains that directionality.
Okay, the balloon is being expanded at the speed of light. And that balloon, the first surface of the balloon, or the first bubble, represents the first cycle of RF energy. And now, in this animation, if you read the article, you'll see that what I propose is that the very next cycle is another bubble inside of the first bubble, expanding at the same rate. The distance between the two bubbles is exactly one wavelength. That's what Mother Nature really does. As the bubble expands, inverse square law tells you the energy is spread out over a greater and greater area, therefore the bubble gets thinner and dimmer. That's what it really does. But there's now, in my example that's in that article, I'm 100 wavelengths away from the antenna, and I've watched 100 bubbles come out, and they're all inside of each other. Each bubble is smaller in radius by exactly one wavelength. And so they're all coming out of that antenna. These bubbles are being born at the antenna. Once every RF cycle, another bubble is born. And the leading edge of that cycle, the phase front of that energy, is a beautiful round bubble, perfectly round sphere. Let me drop. Only if I'm inches away from the antenna is the bubble a little bit of a different shape, but don't worry about that. At any reasonable distance from the antenna, it is a perfect sphere. It is coming out at exactly the speed of light. Whether you're talking about the speed of the signal coming out broadside to the antenna, or the speed of the signal coming out endfire from the off the end of the dipole, it's in all cases it's coming out at the exact same speed of light. It's a completely spherical round bubble being inflated that fast. Each one of these bubbles is being inflated exactly that fast, and they stay exactly that spacing, one wavelength between them. The wavelengths in free space. See, an awful lot of people started talking about, hey, my dipole, if I make my dipole a little bit longer or shorter, does it match the wavelength? Answer is, that's got nothing to do with it. The dipole is at right angles to the phase front that's hitting it. There are bubbles hitting your dipole in the receive mode. And if you're far enough away, the bubble is so large in diameter that the surface that you see looks flat. It really starts off as a sphere. And so the brightness of the bubble tells you exactly how much energy is in that portion of the bubble in that direction away from the dipole. And all of the bubbles get thinner and dimmer as they get further away by the inverse square law. And so that is the real antenna pattern. That donut is a crazy representation. It doesn't exist in the real world. Your eyes at CRF energy, let me drop it. Your eyes at CRF energy would never see that donut. It ain't real. And that cucumber coming out of your Yagi antenna, the signal coming out of the Yagi antenna, is a slightly more complicated bubble. It's got a hot spot at the equator of the bubble, at the prime meridian. The prime meridian, the prime meridian at the equator. That's where the bubble is the brightest. And everywhere away from that, higher or lower in latitude, left or right in longitude, the bubble gets dimmer. That is the real antenna pattern coming out of the Yagi antenna. It's a bunch of bubbles, and each bubble is one wavelength smaller or larger in diameter, depending on when you're talking about an earlier cycle or a later cycle. There's a whole bunch of bubbles coming out of there. And now, in the case of the Yagi antenna, they've got hot spots at the equator, at the prime meridian. That's the bore side of the antenna. That's where the bubble is the brightest and the thickest. Everywhere else, it's very thin and very dim on a high-performance Yagi. Is that picture starting to... I know it's the first time you hear this. It's not an easy concept to get, but I think this is closer to reality, and I wish it was taught this way. If there's any further questions, give me your call letters, K2LIW. As I said, the article that's in K1MGM's website at LimarkTechNet.com, that website, one of the first articles there, the so-called bubble article, which is also called scattering area. It will make this a little bit more clear as to what I'm talking about, and I think it's closer to reality. Go ahead, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, then we can assume from what you're saying, your description, we would be looking, let's say at 10 gig, we would be looking at a radius difference, which would be approximately an inch. So each bubble, even though the outer ones will be getting progressively dimmer, the distance between the bubbles will be approximately an inch, getting brighter toward the antenna. Is that a good description?
That's exactly the right description. The bubbles are 1 inch apart because you've got 1 inch wavelength at 10 gigs. The bubbles are 38 to 24, let me think. Yeah, 240 feet. The bubbles are 240 feet apart in radius at 80 meters. That is the wavelength. I got it right. Yeah, probably 240 feet, 250 feet. Is the distance between the radius of the individual bubbles. What amazes the hell out of me is that this guy I talked to in Rodin, Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, about 10 years ago, sitting on the beach with a 3-foot dish, 10 watts of 10 gig energy into it. He's 380 miles away from me. At that time, I was starting to picture these bubbles coming off his antenna, and each of these bubbles are an inch apart, and there's zillions and zillions of them over that 380-mile range. That signal didn't get tired. It went all of that distance, which is roughly 30, let me think now. My radio horizon is about 40 miles out, and he's 380 miles out. He is 8 times beyond my line of sight. Everybody normally thinks a 10-gig signal, like an optical signal, spreads by line of sight. My radio horizon is out there 40 miles. He's 380 miles away, and he sounds like he's in my backyard with 10 watts of signal on 10 gigs, and all those individual bubbles are 1 inch apart, and there's a zillion of them over that 380 miles. Over to you, John. KQLAW.
KQ2QAQ with comment.
And also, Dick, there are more than one of those bubble paths, and they translate across each other and no interference. Incredible. Glenn, pick it up, sir.
Slightly different question, Dick, and slightly different answer. To your original question about the moon, the Earth, and the tides, removing the tides and creating one engine, did you say that the answer, could one engine do this job?
Absolutely. This Marchionne company, boy, they know how to build engines. Could one engine do the job? Yes. In my opinion, yes. By the way, there's 24 million wavelengths between Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and my QTH. 24 million bubbles. And I'm hearing one of them every tenth of a nanosecond was hitting my antenna. And the signal was 40 dB above the noise. KC2QIQ, K2IW, go ahead, Glenn.
The only reason I've got like 3 pages of calculations right now, and I got a problem with one engine. I don't think it could be done, because if I'm pushing away and I can't change the, well, are we allowed to change the how fast the moon rotates? KC2QIQ.
The moon right now, we're going to leave it alone. It always has the same face aiming toward the Earth. And we're using this rocket in a prograde manner. In other words, we're pushing the moon in the direction it normally moves, and we're pushing it in that direction to speed it up. You could blast the flame of the rocket engine down toward the Earth, and you think you're lifting the moon. That's puzzle number two. That's got an even more surprising answer. Don't do it that way. NASA never does that. NASA either makes a prograde or a retrograde burn of every one of their rocket engines for anything that's in orbit. So you're gonna put the rocket engine on the right-hand limb of the moon from Earth point of view, and the rocket flame is going to aim to the right, so that's pushing the moon toward the left, the direction it's moving, in a prograde manner. You're going to use the rocket engine the most efficient way, and that's the way you're going to use it. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
He said rotation. I think he meant revolution.
For whatever you call it, the moon always has the same face toward the Earth on this nearly circular orbit. Therefore, there's one fixed address on the moon where you mount the rocket, one particular direction in which you aim it, and you never change the direction, you never change the location. You just let the rocket run 24/7, 365 days a year with whatever amount of force required, so that it slowly raises the moon 1.5 inches per year, every year, from now on. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, see, that's where, with my calculations right now, I've got a problem. I don't think that that's possible. And the reason I say that is because the way that the tides are cyclical, in other words, they rise every 12.48 hours, and they rise and they fall. And so, in other words, so if we're looking for an RMS value of energy to do that, the energy would have to be placed upon the moon at an acceleration point, a deceleration, and then a re-acceleration point. So in other words, I don't think you could do it with one engine in one direction. That's what I think the problem is. KC2QIQ.
Hi, the
voltage
is always there, Dan.
You got to think in a celestial manner, Glenn. Assume that you've got this spaceship. You've mounted yourself a million miles above the Earth and Moon. In other words, you've gone from the North Pole straight up, and you're looking down on this system. The Earth is a round object. From that point of view, above the North Pole, you're looking down at it, and it rotates counterclockwise, roughly 24 hours per rotation, 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. That's sidereal. But it's the minor detail. It's rotating counterclockwise, top view. The moon is moving around the Earth counterclockwise again, once per roughly 28 days. So they're both moving in the same direction. You're looking down at the tide. The tide, one portion of the tide is bulging toward the moon, one portion of the tide is bulging away from the moon. The Earth is rotating under that tide. But assuming now you're only looking at the tidal bulge. From your point of view, the tidal bulge is always aimed toward the moon, the forward tidal bulge. And the rearward tidal bulge is always aimed away from the moon on the Earth. From your point of view, the tide looks like it never moves with reference to the moon. Because of tidal friction and the Earth's rotation, the peak of the tidal bulge, let me drop. The peak of the tidal bulge is not exactly toward the moon. It's a little bit further counterclockwise. The tidal bulge slightly leads because of tidal friction. That's what is accelerating the moon. The moon is going toward that gravity center of that bulge. That bulge is always in the same position compared to the moon. You and I on this rotating Earth, we think we see the tide rising and setting. If the Earth was a completely smooth object, the tide would look, from your point of view, a million miles in space, the tide looks like it ain't moving. And you could just barely tell if the Earth is rotating underneath. So the force the tide is creating, except for the fact when the continent of Africa goes by, or the island of Australia goes by, the tide does a little bit of extra wiggling. Or the South America goes whizzing by, a little bit of difference. But that's a minor detail. And we're doing a one-year integration. We're not worrying about what happens per day. There is an extremely close to perfectly continuous force being applied to the moon by the tidal action in a prograde manner. And in this puzzle, for whatever crazy reason, the tide stopped doing that, and the Marchione engine, rocket engine, the ionic engine, is going to do it instead. And from this point of view, a million miles up, you're looking down, you will see the rocket engine on what looks like the right-hand side of the moon, so to speak, and it's blasting in a prograde manner. You're starting to get the picture there, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, sort of. But I guess the still the question remains that, in other words, the force is not constant. I mean, yes, it's constant. In other words, you can come up with, you can RMS value it over a period of time. But you're saying that force, in other words, if provided the tides disappear, that then the force is just basically the difference between the two bodies. Okay, now I understand the problem a little bit differently. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the lunar acceleration due to tides is an extremely close to constant force. But assume now the tide is the only thing that was doing it, the tide stopped doing it, and our rocket engine is going to do it instead. How big a rocket engine, ionic engine, is required to do it? And because you're going to run out of decimal places on your calculator, 1.5 inches per year, you're not going to be able to calculate that. You're going to eventually go to calculating how many inches per million years, and now you're back into using your calculator without underranging it. It's a crazy puzzle. Over to you, Glenn, if you have any questions on it. K2LIW.
No, I got it. I'm trying to get the model right. Before I can do the calculation, I have to understand the problem first. Very good. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, once the tides stopped doing their thing in my crazy scenario, if the rocket engine wasn't there, the moon would be in orbit around the Earth at exactly this same rate and radius. Nothing would change for the next billion years. The only thing that's disturbing it right now is the tides, per se. That's 99% of what's doing it. There's actually some deformation of the Earth of a couple of centimeters. There's really, even if there was absolutely no water on this planet, the presence of the moon and Earth's rotation would create a slight deflection of a couple of centimeters of the Earth itself. You and I think the Earth is a very solid rock. Well, everything's got a Young's modulus to it. You apply a force and you're going to get a deflection. And the moon is deflecting the Earth in a very gentle manner. 99% of the action, of course, is the tide. And the moon is creating, I'm going to pick a number, 95% of the tide. The sun is also a factor, but a very minor one by comparison. Okay, we're down to the last 2 minutes. This craziest of all technets with a little bit of celestial jazz thrown in was technet number 1508 of the series that began in September of 1982. Every so often, in my crazy vanity, I go back and listen to some of these recordings on the amateurradio.tv. And I'm amazed how many times I create spoonerisms. And now I meant to say left and I said right or vice versa, if you know what I mean. Hey, John. It's time you start to, taking your bright yellow paint can, spray paint can, and start marking the marks on the driveway where the hole's going to be dug, where the foundation is going to go, where the tower is going to go. KC2WGB. I'm having some fun with him. KC2LIW.
Yeah, I guess the tennis courts will have to go. more important. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us on the net and making it interesting, as usual, and hope to hear you all back here next week. And we're going to try to be here, and we'll keep this going. Maybe we'll actually have some answers. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If you think the problem is simple, you don't understand the problem. Yeah, we're oversimplifying all these things, but there's some education here, in my opinion. The binary system called Earth-Moon, it's not too hard to understand if it's presented to you the right way, and many of the schools have done not so good a job. The average student, if he was given a 50-cent piece, which represents the Earth, and a dime that represents the Moon, and that's close, and he's asked to put them on the table at the right distance, he'd be kind of amazed. Take the radius of the Earth, multiply it by 60, 6-0. That's the distance to the Moon. 60 Earth radii away. They're amazingly far away in reality compared to the way we all see a diagram in the book and the way we'd all draw it. Geosynchronous orbit is 6 Earth radii away. 10% of the distance to the Moon is where geosynchronous orbit is. Okay. 73, you all. Bye-bye. Enjoy. And if we all stay healthy, we'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. So, some of these guys are mistreating each other, in my opinion. This is a hobby. Don't get angry. Any dumb fool can get angry. You're not much bigger than the thing that makes you angry. It's simplistic, but there's a degree of truth in it. There's bigger fish to fry. Bye-bye, you all. KQIW.
Good night, Dave. Thank you. 73's, guys. We'll be back. Have some more fun. N2XJN, KC2WGB. Loving Earth, KC2WGB clear.
What's wrong, Mike? N2XJN, KC2WGB.
Nothing heard. KC2WGB clear.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.